This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm Gaius, and Germanicus is here, and we're in Londinium enjoying our cup of wine and looking 2,000 years into the future to a remarkable document in these last days from the capital of Spain, Madrid, where the NATO chieftains were meeting to discuss what they call a strategic concept. Who is the enemy, and what are we going to do about it? What are our ambitions? Well, right now we have existential threat language about Russia. Because of Ukraine, because of the frontier that is now to be rearmed. Back to the Cold War plus. However, there is something fresh in this document that I asked Germanicus to comment on. Paragraph 13. The People's Republic of China, PRC, stated ambitions and coercive policies challenge our, NATO's, interests, security, and values. The PRC employs a broad range of political, economic, and military tools to increase its global footprint and project power while remaining opaque about its strategy, intentions, and military buildup. The PRC's malicious hybrid and cyber operations and its confrontational rhetoric and disinformation target allies and harm alliance security. I'll stop there, Germanicus. Malicious, moral language, condemning a nascent military power. That would be the People's Republic of China. This strikes me as taking on yet another unknown, which is an existential contest with Beijing. Were you surprised to see this in the NATO document?
Nothing at this point that NATO can do will surprise me, because NATO has, for the last several months, along with the U.S. leadership, pushed a policy of increasing confrontation and escalation, and that's extremely dangerous. And rather than trying to, as one would imagine, a good strategist would want to do, rather than trying to pry open the tight relationship between China and Russia, it has done everything to bring them closer and closer together and to encourage their solidarity in the face of a now clearly threatening NATO. So it's fascinating, again, as the language used to describe Russian evil and malice, the PRC is being accused of acting like a great power. It's being accused of increasing its influence and leverage in the world. And it is remarkable that that NATO can show such chutzpah without losing control of its own facial expressions as it delivers the speech, because this is how any great power is going to act. And it's a competition. It's no different from what the Chinese, the Soviets did back in the height of the Cold War. And also, it is fascinating to me to see how probably the most pernicious and yet most significant consequence of the Western engagement in Afghanistan was the way in which the U.S. was able to make it a NATO intervention, and thus to bring the Euro-Atlantic, as it were, as improbable as the idea might be, into the very heart of Central Asia and now into the Pacific itself. In other words, it's quite clear that NATO is no longer about Euro-Atlantic metaphors. NATO, the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Japan, and Korea, together with Canada, I mean all of North America, form what amounts to U.S. realm, or the Euro-U.S. realm. And this is, in many ways, a document that is a declaration of this new order, as it were. And what's fascinating about this order, including the fact that it takes on China as well as Russia, is that it essentially is helping to shape the very thing that that thinkers alleged thinkers were saying should not be done, which is not only to drive Russia and China together, but to create a very powerful opposing bloc, something that would go well beyond what the allies, NATO, the U.S. faced in the Cold War, which was a relatively circumscribed Russia and a very weak China, and a situation where the free world literally meant most of the world. That was the actual world. Now what we're seeing with an ever-tightening relationship among the BRICS, in which India is now a player that has moved closer and closer over to the Russian and Chinese side of things, you're beginning to see a sort of bipolar split emerging, or at least two large power blocks emerging, that the U.S. is not well suited, along with Europe, to compete against, because these are the most enterprising and vibrant and dynamic economies in the world today, and they represent much of the future. And for the U.S. to create a smaller world, a kind of a modern 21st century of Orwell's Oceania, is to lock ourselves in to a smaller block, a smaller realm, maybe like Rome was as it began its decline, no longer a universalist vision, but now simply trying to maintain itself against some very powerful competitors.
My puzzle, Germanicus, is that the language suggests rearmament, expansion of the frontiers. And we see that with adding Sweden and Finland. There'll be more additions. We can anticipate it. Militarizing the Baltic Sea as well as the Black Sea. And an escalation and the industrial arms everywhere. The companies that were not shriveling, but certainly looking for other opportunities, the great industrial complex, military-industrial complex, is now reawakened. And not just here, but in the United Kingdom, in Paris, in Germany, all along the frontier. And we can see the same thing in Asia. Are we going to re-engage in Cold War armament? Is that where we're headed?
I think this is a very powerful insight, because it speaks to what has been a pernicious development in the U.S. Over the last several decades of what people call the Forever War. And that is that the most dynamic aspect of American power is its military power. And it's the one remaining advantage, at least in our own minds, that we can employ to maintain our competitiveness. And it can be used as a way to keep the economy ratcheted up, which is to say, having a kind of a mobilization economy. Now, that's certainly how Germany rearmed in the 30s, but also the U.S. and Britain, too, and Russia industrializing at that time. And then the U.S. did that again at the height of the Cold War. Remember, we were spending 8 to 10% of our GDP. And so this is a way, I think, to try and kickstart Western economies that have become stagnant and unproductive and have, to a large extent, deindustrialized. But as any economist will point out, relying on a military buildup to reinvigorate and revive your economy is extremely inefficient way to go about things. Plus, you have the very worrisome collateral dimension of large militaries that have to be used, that constantly tempt leaders to put them to use, especially when the economic competition is not going well. And that, I think, is also what we're seeing here, is the U.S. is falling back on what it thinks is its comparative advantage in the world today, and that is in the military. And I don't think that is really true any longer.
Does NATO intend to conquer Beijing and Moscow? Simple question. We have about a minute.
I think in the wildest imaginings, of the courtiers in the precincts of the imperial city here in Washington would want to see first the prostration and then the so-called decolonization of Russia and its breaking up, and then a situation where somehow the ring around China can be completed and tightened, and this would involve enlisting India and others, and that's not likely now, I don't think.
Right.
But it would create an economic vise around China. China would be more isolated and more disheartened by the prostration of Russia. So, but I do think it is that kind of open-ended, unconditional surrender approach that the U.S. has fallen back on ever since Ulysses S. Grant back at Fort Donelson, 1862.
Let us get to the Greek Theater. Finish your wine, Germanicus. We're going to see Aeschylus tonight, which I favor. I know it's preachy, but at least they'll contest each other, these humans, because the gods interfere. They always interfere in Greek plays. I sometimes think that the gods do not have a sense of humor, and then I puzzle. Anyway, we'll sacrifice to the god Augustus. We'll pay our dues to Domitian. He's semi-divine. And we will speak again of these NATO gatherings, which now looks to have declared some kind of existential war on twin capitals of Eurasia. And the United States is doing this with two oceans between us and the threat. Europe is right up against it. And we will cross the Atlantic, we will hold the Atlantic, and then... This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.